love, and rock and roll.
To those seeking freedom, to those committed to abolishing slavery, to those who want liberation for all, this is a message from the revolutionary abolitionist movement. The United States was built on slavery, and despite the American Civil War, this oppression never ended. The abolitionist movement fought against this tyranny, but modern slavery and mass brutality persist unchecked. Fascism is on the rise. The state has openly declared war on our communities, threatening to ethnically cleanse Latinos, criminalize Muslims, destroy indigenous land, and oppress the LGBT community, while continuing to murder and incarcerate black people. The revolutionary abolitionist movement unequivocally states the plantation system must be destroyed. Today, the anarchist struggle and anti-statist feminism are flourishing, and authoritarian modes of resistance have been discredited. The Rojava Revolution in northern Syria has set a new standard with a foundation of feminism, ecology, anti-state organizing, and armed struggle. It has actualized the path towards liberation beyond 20th century nationalism. With the founding of groups like the International Revolutionary People's Guerrilla Forces, it is clear that this is the time for anarchist revolutionaries to act without hesitation. We declare our solidarity with the international anti-fascist and anarchist struggle and propose concrete steps in the fight for abolition. Revolutionary abolitionists must fight hand in hand with those facing oppression. We intend to establish a new underground railroad to free people from bondage by building revolutionary self-defense networks, connecting them to one another, and developing militant strategies in their neighborhoods. Our network will create the capacity to destroy state power and defend our communities. A new global paradigm for revolution has been established to be taken up by dedicated, committed revolutionaries, autonomous territories, guerrillas in armed struggle, and all those engaged in the global drive for his liberation and away from statehood, capitalism, patriarchy, and domination. We call on anti-state revolutionaries to join the revolutionary abolitionist movement and send this message to our comrades to help build the capacity to burn down the American plantation once and for all. Welcome to Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio. This is your host and comrade, Sergio Castillo. We are here live on Radio Free Brooklyn. Welcome, 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 comrades, to another edition of Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio. I am your host and comrade, Sergio Castillo. Thank you so much for joining us. As always, a few announcements from Radio Free Brooklyn. As you know, COVID-19 has disrupted all of our lives, and we at Radio Free Brooklyn are no different. So we would greatly appreciate any kind of donation that you can give, big or small. It helps us keep this operation going. We are a nonprofit organization, so any donation that you can give is greatly appreciated. You can go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate in order to do that. If you'd like to listen to Radio Free Brooklyn when you're not in front of your computer, please consider downloading our free mobile app for iPhone and Android, available in the App Store for iPhone or the Google Play Store for Android. Please be sure to subscribe to our monthly newsletter for the latest news about new programming and upcoming Radio Free Brooklyn events. You can sign up at radiofreebrooklyn.org/newsletter. And one additional announcement. Radio Free Brooklyn is sponsored in part by ProCare Biomedical Repair, offering little or no cost medical braces. More information is available at 844-598-6639. So there's that. Our guest today marks another chapter in our program's journey to freedom and liberation. She is an actor, producer, and documentary filmmaker. In 2010, she received a Master of Fine Arts degree in acting from the Actors Theater Drama School at Pace University. Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio is very proud to welcome Natalie Claire Holly. Natalie, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Sylvia.
Where to begin? Perhaps at the beginning. Natalie, where were you born?
Queens, New York.
What was your father's name?
Gennad.
And what was his occupation?
Teacher.
What was your mother's name?
Florence.
What was her occupation?
Rehabilitation counselor.
And here you and I believe, have something in common. You correct me if I'm wrong, but we are both the children of immigrants.
Yes, we are.
What country were your parents born in?
They were both born in Haiti. My father was born and raised in Haiti, and my mother was born in Haiti but raised in Liberia before she came to the U.S.
Did storytelling play a role for you as a child?
Definitely. I think my parents are both, they may not have necessarily known what to do with my interest in storytelling, but my parents very much encouraged it. So we were read to a lot, and my sister and I, we were always creative, you know, creating things, you know, plays, dances, writing, you know, poetry, short stories, that sort of thing in the house. I think very early on, we did not watch a lot of TV at all. So that really lent itself to giving us a lot of free time to just to play and to be really creative in the house.
What was the name of your elementary school?
PS 98.
What was the name of your middle school?
MS 67.
What high school did you attend?
Benjamin Cardozo High School.
Were you a good student?
I was an average student.
When did you discover that the theater would play a significant role in your life?
I loved reading. I was a strong reader from the time I was very little. I was in college when I actually started to pay attention to the theater and to consider that it was something, to consider it as something that I could actually do and be good at and possibly even explore as a career. So college, undergrad.
What college did you attend?
Wells College.
And you said that was where you discovered theater. Did they had a theater department?
They had a theater department, but I was in the sociology and anthropology department. But all of my interests were in theater, were in the fine arts in general. So I had done theater, had auditioned and done, I've had a couple of roles while I was in college and, you know, read a lot of plays. I had studied Francophone literature at some point in Senegal, and that also included West African theater traditions and that sort of thing. It was basically in my final year of college is when I decided that I would actually pursue theater, and I started looking at master's in fine arts programs.
Just to take a step back for a moment, what initially drew you to sociology?
Because I really just wanted to make sense of why the world was, the way it is. I think growing up, reading a lot, and you know, my sister and I having our experiences as Black women in this world, as first-generation Americans, you know, listening to my parents talk about their experiences in Liberia and in Haiti, my grandparents talking about that sort of thing, I think I had a lot of questions. I think there were a lot of observations that I was, that I had been making from the time I was very little. And, like I remember, I always tell people, I remember being very young in elementary school. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, now people are talking about critical race theory and having a more inclusive, school curriculum. But I was very young in elementary school when we would be given, this is public school, and we would be given our history textbooks. And I remember pretty much regularly flipping through the textbook, looking for stories about Black people. And I remember always finding, of course, a section about the Civil Rights Movement and Martin Luther King. And there might be a little something about Malcolm X or the Black Panthers. And then, and I might find a little something about the Haitian Revolution. And then once I was satisfied that this was what all it contained, the book contained about Black people, I would start, okay, where are the other stories about people of color? And I was doing that at a very young age. So it's interesting that we're now having this conversation. As I got older and I went to college and I started learning about the, so that there's an actual term, sociology, that there are classes that you, where you learn about the history of society and social problems and inequalities and why things are the way they are and how they're tied to history and economics and policy and all of those things, that I think was what really piqued my interest. And I realized, okay, there's a name for all of this, and it's sociology and anthropology.
In 2007, you made a significant choice to attend the Actors Studio Drama School at Pace University. What inspired this decision?
I always respected good writing and good acting. And the great the performances that I really enjoyed, the ones that I really enjoyed and those that I really respected, I learned that they were all, a lot of them were getting this thing called an MFA. And I learned that people actually study, you know, there's study to show thyself approved. And I learned that people actually study this thing and to be good at it, to get tools and to just speak the same language and to be able to articulate yourself with people in the industry or people who are at least practicing the craft. I mean, so that's generally why I pursued it. I wanted to learn and to be able to do things and to be equipped, right? To be knowledgeable and to be equipped the same way I would if I were pursuing any other profession. If I wanted to be a doctor, I would go to medical school.
Right.
So that was my reasoning with this. I should learn and learn from and study the Greeks.
What attracted you to the method?
The method attracted me because I think it's a tool, right? It's a tool that I think that helps you to be vulnerable when you need to be. But like any other tool, you also learn when to put it down. So you can go deep into an experience, you can go deep into a character that you can portray. And the method allows you, I think, to do that, to explore all of the different aspects of the character development and teaches you how to relax and to be vulnerable and to be in the moment and all of those things that I think really contribute to a great and authentic performance. But I think what often doesn't get said about the method is that it also teaches you how to go in and then how to get out.
I
think it's critical.
What was your thesis?
My thesis was The Prisoner of Second Avenue.
And who was the author?
The Prisoner of Second Avenue. The Prisoner of Second Avenue, we had done, I think it was under, we had, my thesis advisor was the late Elizabeth Kemp.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a two-person scene. And it's a scene where the couple has just gotten robbed.
Who is the author of the play?
Neil Simon.
How has being the daughter of immigrants impacted your work in theater and film?
Um, I think being the daughter of immigrants, you know, and I said I'm first generation. My parents have been here for a long time. Mm. But, you know, but they still, of course, carry their experiences with them from Haiti and Liberia. I think that, it gives me added perspective. I think there was something, I think it gives me additional layers. I think it gives me additional layers to my storytelling. It gives me added perspective. It gives me something else that I'm bringing to the table. When I'm acting, when I'm writing, it gives me different, what I would say, I guess, shades or tones to how I'm working. I mean, immigrants come with accents, right? And immigrants come with a different way of carrying themselves, even. You notice this, right? The way they carry themselves. When I say carry themselves, I say the way they move in space, the way they move in the world, the way they speak, even how they hold memories, right? I think all of those things helped to color and like helped me to add another dimension to my storytelling. And I think the longer I, the longer I'm here, and the longer, and if I stay, if I don't remain connected to that, I lose it for sure. I do know that it's really important for me to hold on to what I've gotten from my parents and from my grandparents. And just even from my own experiences of, you know, living and working in Haiti and that sort of thing. Being in this country, I think sometimes if I'm not careful, I could end up being in a very narrow space. I could end up storytelling from a limited or narrow perspective that isn't flexible otherwise.
And this sort of leads me to my next question. Recently, and I wanted to do the structure of this episode a little bit differently, because I know you have recently ventured into the world of documentary filmmaking, and I would love it if you could tell us about your latest project and what has inspired it.
So my latest project is about African-American immigration. And so African-Americans have historically have sought opportunities to go elsewhere, to leave the U.S. They've gone to Liberia. They've gone to Haiti. They've gone to parts of South America. They've gone to Canada. And often in history, we talk about them as immigrants, spelled with an E. E-M-M-I-G-R-A-N-T, which is really when people leave a country to go elsewhere, right? Which then puts the U.S. as the storyteller, the point of view in that case, if we're calling them immigrants. And I'm choosing to call them immigrants, I-M-M-I-G-R-A-N-T, because the same way that we look at Irish immigrants or Haitian immigrants or Russian immigrants or so forth, they left their native land to come, to go somewhere else, to go often to come to the U.S. for better, in search of better opportunities and what have you. And this is actually a story about African Americans who have chosen to leave the U.S. to go elsewhere in search of better opportunities. And so, and this is a 6-part short docuseries. And my personal connection to it is that my great, great, great grandfather was a leader in a movement of bringing African Americans to Haiti in 1861, which is about 2 years before the Civil War. Mm-hmm.
Haiti has a legacy of revolutionary activity. And I believe it was actually the first, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was the first democracy the world had in the Western Hemisphere. And
the first Black Republic, that's right.
Right. And I'm wondering if you can discuss what is the legacy of the Haitian Revolution.
I think the legacy of the Haitian Revolution is, I mean, it's a tremendous legacy, the first Black country to win its independence through a successful slave revolt. I think that is often followed with where Haiti is now, right? And I think, but before I get to that point, the legacy of the Haitian Revolution is that, it would be an understatement to say that was a big deal, right?
Right.
It was a successful slave revolt of African enslaved people who revolted against their white French slave masters and slave owners. And in becoming an independent black republic, right, in the Western Hemisphere, where other black people, whether they were in the Caribbean or in the U.S., were enslaved. They were enslaved. So these were the only black people in the Western Hemisphere who were free. As a matter, I would say in the world. No, actually, they were the only black people at that time in the world who were free. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think maybe Ethiopians were free as well. But Haitians had become free and were free and independent and running their own country at the time when black people were enslaved in the Caribbean and in Africa and in other parts of the world, and in the Caribbean and the U.S. are colonized and enslaved in other parts of the world. I think one of the things that often doesn't get shared or said enough is that that was very influential to African Americans. It was influential to black people the world over. Mm-hmm. You can imagine. Yeah. And it actually influenced other slave rebellions like Nat Turner's insurrection. There are towns named after Haiti. There were back then, black towns that had been named after Haiti at the time, spelled Haiti, and today it's spelled Haiti. And there was a concerted effort by the powers that be, by the oppressors, by the U.S. government and other governments to subdue that, right? To subdue the reaction, to subdue the influence. And so there wasn't trade with Haiti at the time. So there wasn't trade with Haiti. There was very limited, they couldn't let other black people be inspired by the Haitian Revolution. Because you can imagine what that would have done, what chaos would have ensued, right? If black people the world over were inspired, they might get ideas. They might get bright ideas about who they are, who they're meant to be, how they're supposed to be in this world. Thoughts of crazy ideas about freedom and agency, independence, and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it's an understatement to say that it was a huge legacy, but it was definitely, it's a pivotal moment. And I'll say this, not just in Haitian history, it's a pivotal moment in world history that I think we should really start to, that needs to be recognized.
In the notion of African Americans returning to, the homeland, goes even before Marcus Garvey. I mean, I believe they're one of the laws of, after the success of the Haitian Revolution, was that anybody who was black that landed on Haitian soil would be considered free. And so it had this sort of global impact for the enslaved Africans all around the world.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So you had, sometimes there would be, slave owners who had slaves manning ships from other places that would dock in Haiti. And their enslaved people would escape. And once you're on Haitian land, you're independent. You're free. Haiti did not recognize slavery. And so Haiti also has a history of being a safe haven for the oppressed. And we're talking about, Lebanese or Syrians fleeing, oppressive situations in Lebanon and Syria. Even during the Holocaust, Jewish people fleeing and coming to Haiti. And so really there's you've got folks from different countries in Europe and so forth, but then you also had African Americans too leaving, and there was a movement in the 1820s, and then with my great great grandfather James Theodore Holly in the 1860s, and then even now today there are smaller groups, but there are definitely people who are making the decision, even in our generation, to go, whether it's to Ghana or Nigeria or just to go to Haiti. Now, some of them are first-generation Americans, and they actually have a personal history there. But there are also those who don't have a personal history there that I've met who are choosing to go elsewhere. And I think one of the other things with that is that I think it's been so ingrained in our minds that and just the way history is told, it's been so ingrained that the U.S. is the destination. The United States is the goal, that this is the land of the free. This is where people go for their to reach, to realize their purpose, realize their dreams, and to get opportunities. But for many African Americans, back then believed that, well, there were folks leaving their countries to come to the U.S., and it was the American dream for them. For African Americans, it was a nightmare,
yeah.
And they were choosing to go to Haiti. And I think now, even today, there are people that are, these conversations are being had right now where folks are deciding to leave the U.S. altogether to go elsewhere, whether it's Haiti or somewhere else, but they're choosing to go elsewhere. And it just subverts the idea that the U.S. is the be-all, end-all, that it's the goal and the destination.
I want to return to that point in a minute. And I also want to bring up the point that, and again, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think at the time, one of the new laws that was created in the Haitian Republic was that anybody who landed on Haiti, any enslaved person, would be considered black, and all black people are considered free in Haiti. One of the kind of ingenious things about what they did is if you land on Haiti, you will be considered black regardless of skin color. It was worded in a particular way, which is why I think, as you said, people who were fleeing the Holocaust during World War II came to Haiti, and they were considered free automatically. I don't know if it's still worded that way in their constitution or not, but I wanted to ask you what inspired you personally to, because for a time being you went and moved to Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And can you talk to us of what inspired that decision and what you learned from that experience?
Yeah, I did. I decided to move to Haiti shortly after completing my MFA at the Actors Studio. Mm-hmm. And I just remember at the time, I think it was about a year or so after I'd finished the program, but at the time there was a lot going on. I mean, there's still a lot going on right now, politically and racially, I mean. And I think the Black Lives Matters movement hadn't even started yet. I think that wouldn't be for another year or two, I believe. But we were gearing up. We were going in that direction, right? There had been several unarmed shootings of Black people. So that was one thing. That was one event that I remember taking place that made me feel like I kind of want to get away for a little bit. So that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect of it was that I had just gotten my degree, and I really, really loved the program at the Actors Studio. I loved my teachers. I loved my experiences. But I overall didn't really feel like I had enough to say, if I'm being honest. I remember saying this to one of our classmates. I remember saying this to her. I don't think that I had, and this was an older classmate who had a lot of life experiences, and she came to the Actor Studio as an older student. And I remember telling her, Sergio, I remember telling her, I don't think that I have enough to say right now. I don't think that I think that I need to do more. I need to actually step away from the theater and go have other experiences. I need to live a little bit more. And I did. I know that I didn't need to go to Haiti in order to do that. I could have done that by living in New York. But the third event was the earthquake. The earthquake happened.
Yeah.
And I was still in the program during the 2010 earthquake. And I remember feeling, it really hit me emotionally and hit like so many Haitians, no matter how far away and distant culturally you feel from Haiti. When it happened, it brought a lot of people together. And I remember feeling like I want to understand what's happening, and I'm not going to understand that by being here. You know, I'd started writing a piece for we had a movement class at Actor Studio that I had written a piece for that eventually became a pilot script that I had completed while living in Haiti. But as I was writing those characters, I didn't know enough about them. And that's what the method teaches you, right? Part of the method is, you know, doing the work, doing the research, studying, living, you know, trying to walk in the shoes of those characters to understand their reality, right? Their lived experiences. And so I think the political culture at the time, feeling like I didn't have enough to say, and then the earthquake and how it was influencing my writing, that script at the time, all of those things came together and really just inspired me and pushed me to move to Haiti.
Do you think that Black, Brown, and Indigenous artists in America have a lot to learn from their roots?
Oh, yeah. From our roots?
Yes.
Oh, I definitely think so. I definitely think so. I am not sure how much I did. I'll say this. Living and, you know, becoming a better Creole speaker, for example, by living in Haiti. And just being there and coming back with a different perspective, with a new, informed, and sharper, and refined perspective, it helped me a lot. I think I needed to even hear how my grandparents lived in the States, and my grandparents died just a few years ago, but you know, they were living in the States while I was there. But even me going back there and coming back and listening to my grandparents, I became a different type of listener. Do you know what I mean?
Talk to us about that.
So I was listening differently. I was understanding. I'll never say that I completely understand. I think it would be very arrogant of me to say that I completely understand my grandparents' experience and my parents' experiences. I can't say that, right? But I know that I have a little more clarity. And if I could just get a little bit more clarity, if we could all just get a little bit more clarity, especially as Black and Brown and Indigenous people, that comes from being, you know, reaching back and getting within close proximity to our roots, I think we're better for it. I think we're 100% better for it. I think we're nourished by it. We're fed by it. It helps to define us for sure.
Well, I think just in my experience, it always seems that, you know, again, Black, Brown, and Indigenous artists in America are constantly searching for our own sense of identity in this sort of very bizarre culture and land. And going back to our roots, at the very least, it gives us a perspective of when we were not enslaved, of when we were not defined by our genocide by European and European Americans. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that this notion of returning to the homeland is something I find quite, you know, fascinating, an idea, whether it was Marcus Garvey who talked about it in a literal sense, Malcolm X in abstract sense. But can you talk to us more about this documentary that explores the notion of returning to the homeland, essentially?
Yeah, so the documentary, it follows the history of African Americans leaving and going to the U.S., going as far back as the 1700s to the present. And in that is Garveyism, the period of Garveyism, the period with the American colonization, which was the American Colonization Society, which was a controversial government institution, U.S. government institution that was supposedly to help African Americans, quote unquote, return home, quote unquote, to Liberia and Sierra Leone, And then there's also the movement led by James Theodore Holly of African Americans to Haiti in the 1860s. And then before that, when about 2,000 African Americans went with the help of the Haitian government to Haiti. So this series follows that the arc of that of this history. But returning home, I think. Let's see if I can answer the question. In terms of returning home, it's interesting because, you know, I'll say this, I grew up, you know, with Haitian parents and Haitian grandparents, but my last name, Holly, is obviously not a Haitian last name. It's an Anglophone name that I could never explain to people. I never knew where this name came from until I was in college and my father told me that there was this book called Defender of the Race that my uncle gave him. And someone wrote a book about our distant relative who was the first Black bishop of the Episcopal Church, and his name was James Theodore Holly. And at the time, we're not Episcopalian. I didn't have connection to this. I didn't understand what it meant. The way it had been presented to me, it didn't necessarily pique my interest. But when I was in Haiti, and I was in the back of a motorcycle, and the motorcycle driver was taking me to work, and we went up a dusty hill, and I see the street sign. It says Rue Armand Ollier. So it's Armand Holly Street. And that was the first time that I saw my last name in a Haitian context. I didn't know any Hollies growing up. My father wasn't close to his father's family. So even just not being close to the Holly family at all, I really didn't have anything to inform that experience. So when we talk about going home, me as a first generation American to Haitian parents, I'm going, I guess, quote, back to Haiti, which I wasn't born there. I hadn't been raised there, but it is influential in my identity and who I am. So it really is a return for me, I guess, to connect to my roots. But realizing that for James Theodore Holly, Haiti was home for him as well. He made Haiti his home. And he wasn't born there. He wasn't raised there. He was a grown adult bringing adult men and children and men, women, and children to Haiti who would eventually call it home as well. He made it. And so I think when we talk about returning home, I think not all children of immigrants are going, might maybe interested. Not every one of us is going to go back to where their parents or grandparents came from or where they were born.
Right.
But they are going to try to make a home for themselves wherever they are, whether that is surrounding themselves with people from that community in a foreign land that can be home. Or, you know, what I did in Haiti, being around my family and other Haitian American expats, and where we commiserate about our experiences being both American and of Haitian descent, and making sense of that, crafting that identity, you know, making sense of that and figuring out how that, it doesn't take over your entire identity, but it certainly influences it and shapes it. But figuring out what place that it has in it. And then for people like James Theodore Holly and the people that went with him, or the people that went, you know, to Liberia through Garveyism or through the American Colonization Society, they were Black and they were American of African descent, and chose a country that they didn't know, a culture that they were not familiar with, a language that they had to learn, but they made that place home. And I don't know. I think there's a lot that goes into what defines home for people. Like, I think there's a return. I think when we talk about returning home, we're finding something that's familiar in that place, and we're reaching out to grab it. That's the return. And I think for some people who are just going home, like James Theodore Holly and the people that went with him, or the folks who went through Garveyism, they are leaving what doesn't benefit them anymore, what's been hostile to them, what's breaking them, what isn't going to serve their children. And they're going to go somewhere else where there's a promise, where there's hope. I'm not sure. how much that answers your question.
Well, tell us more about what home means to you.
I think home is where you can be yourself, where you can be all of the things that make up who you are. I don't think that any of us are any one thing, and I no longer think that we have to subscribe to any one thing. So, for example, I'm Haitian American. I can't help that. It's influenced me and shaped who I am. I think even some of the choices that I make, you know, my faith, what I decide to do with my life, how I decide, you know, as a storyteller, who I decide to share my life with. I think all of those things contribute and make my home. And, you know, I think where I think my hopes are realized, I think the promises, where the promise is, where the hope is, I think it also helps to influence what makes up my home. So I think it's a lot. I think it can be a number of different things. I think it's nuanced. I think it's complex. It's a lot.
I agree. It sounds like it's a bit more abstract for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Has studying theater formerly helped or hindered your skills as a documentary filmmaker?
I think it helped. I definitely think it helped. Because, I mean, I think theater helped me to be even more curious about people's experiences. So I think it helps you to ask the right questions. I think with theater, you really want to walk in someone's shoes, right? And to live there and understand their lived experience. And the way that you get there is by being curious. And so theater, I mean, studying the playwrights that we studied, you know, taking, you know, the basic acting technique and the scene study and all of those different classes. I think as a documentarian, writing the script and you know, doing the research, but then also being in the moment when I'm interviewing people, like a lot of that, I didn't realize when I was doing this, I already had a lot of those tools from our MFA program, because it helped me build my curiosity, to help me to know what questions to ask and to be in the moment with people who are sharing their stories with me, whether these are historians who are very passionate about the subject matter that they've been writing about for many years and writing dissertations about, but also whether it's, you know, children of historical, you know, descendants of historical figures, people who have held these stories very close to them with great pride. Being in the moment with those people, I think I learned to do that, and I learned to be with them and to ask those questions and to help move their story forward through my experience at the MFA program.
What is the responsibility of the artist to political culture?
To tell the truth. Definitely, I think, to tell the truth. And to reflect society in a truthful and responsible way. Responsible doesn't necessarily mean safe either. You can shake things up and be responsible.
And talk to us more about that.
I think, you know, I feel like documentaries are doing what history classes, or at least, you know, what general, at least through K-12 education, history classes haven't, couldn't, or wouldn't do for mainstream audiences. And so we have to supplement our education often with books that we choose to read and documentary series and films that we choose to watch, that aren't necessarily, that aren't going to be shown and shared in the school system. So we know, like, we're observing what's happening around us politically and socially, and that's not being explained to us in our, in K-12 the K-12 education system. That's not being explained. It's not being shared. Those, the other perspectives, especially of perspectives of marginalized people, aren't included. It isn't an inclusive education system. So documentaries are an opportunity for us to tell the truth and to present what's missing in the canon. Like, here's what's actually, here's the rest of the story. You've heard this version. Now here's this perspective. Here's this story. Here's what more you have to learn, you have to hear, to come up with your own conclusion. Because right now, your opinion and the conclusion that you've come to is incomplete. They're not fully informed. They're not taking into account all of the perspectives that are to be included in telling a story. They are limited. You've been told something from a very limited and narrow point of view, which goes back to what I said in the beginning when I said I'm choosing to call the documentary is about African American immigrants instead of African American immigrants, because that was often, when you use the word immigrant, E-M-M, it's usually from the perspective of the country from which those people are leaving. But if you just take that story of these African Americans choosing to leave and go elsewhere, they become immigrants like any other group. And we're inspired by them. We're inspired. I think even just in general, we're inspired by people who have done a really difficult thing and overcome, right? Like, we love stories about the underdog, yeah, and people who overcome things and do really challenging things and fight for what they want. Well, that's what immigrants have done from the history of immigration. Immigrants have been the underdog. They've had to let go and rebuild and reconstruct. And so I think the responsibility of documentarians is to tell the truth about society, to show a reflection of what it really and truly is, not what the powers have be have implicitly told us it should be, or have influenced us, or made us feel that it should be. If I'm saying that clearly enough.
Do you see the climate changing for women, and maybe more in particular, Black women in the entertainment industry?
I do. I think that space is being made. I definitely think that there's a lot of space being made. I won't say a lot, because I don't think that I have enough of an insider view. But from my seat, I'm seeing that that there's a shift. And I think a lot of that is, you know, where the money is, right? The folks are noticed, the powers that they are noticing are taking into account that people want more diverse storytelling. They want to hear stories about women and Black women and people of color and indigenous people. We're craving that. I think that space is being made. I actually think that it has to be made at this point. I don't think that there's any going back. I don't think that we would let them. I think that we've gotten loud. I think that we've gotten boisterous and disruptive. I think that social media has really impacted that as well. I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find, and it still happens. It still happens, believe it or not, that there are still all white sets and all white, talent and directors and producers and so forth. But there's backlash, and it's swift. So I think that the space has had to be made for BIPOC artists and creators and LGBTQ artists and creators. And I think the space has had to be made, and there isn't going back, and that shift is happening. And I think the world will have to adapt. Because what happens is, if at least if Hollywood doesn't make the space, a lot of this has been democratized anyway. And someone can pick up their phone and create something, or they can create theater, or they can write an article. And the information and the stories will get out there to people who care faster than they've been able to in the past. So I think what happens now is that the establishment has had to take notice and has had to adapt accordingly.
Do you think that it should be approached, or maybe let me rephrase that. Do you think that there is a danger in approaching this from sort of a capitalist point of view as opposed to, say, a revolutionary point of view? Because historically, I mean, we have been, again, when I say we, the Black, Brown, and Indigenous people, been disenfranchised by the capitalist system, not only in the United States, but around the world. And do you think approaching it from a money-making point of view can help or hinder the movement as a whole?
I think as a whole, it could hinder the movement. I do think so as a whole. But I think, do I think that space is necessarily being made necessarily because there is a change of heart that the powers of be necessarily care and want to hear these stories? I'm not sure if hearts change that fast. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the civil rights movement wasn't successful because all of a sudden white people stopped being racist.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I mean, it had to be approached from an economic standpoint, and then they had to have laws. And then maybe you hope that attitudes and behavior change. But I think that the revolution comes from, I think it comes from within. I think revolutionaries are who make lasting change, and they don't necessarily see the lasting change. They at least influence it. They bend that moral arc toward justice. They bend it, but they never get there. They don't see it necessarily. They don't. They don't see it. I think that what happens is, if we're loud enough, we're boisterous, and we shake things enough, you know, then it disrupts this capitalist system, right? Like the bus boycotts did during the civil rights movement. And I think now, you know, social media is swift. People are quick to cancel. So things have to change. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the revolution is won.
You are listening to Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn. We are here with actor, producer, filmmaker Natalie Claire Holly. We are going to take a quick break, and we will return in a moment. So here's a little bit of Bob Marley for you here on Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio.
We're moving right out of Babylon, and we're going to our father's land. Yeah. How good and how pleasant it would be before God and man, yeah, to see the unification of all Africans. Yeah. As it's been said already,
of course, is the jingle to Inside the Actor Studio. And now we turn to my favorite segment of our program, the Proust Questionnaire. the questionnaire devised but not necessarily invented by Marcel Proust, adapted for television by the French talk show host Bernard Pivot, and of course perfected by the late, great James Lipton of Inside the Actors Studio, who is something of an indirect mentor of mine, and our guest, Natalie Claire Holly. Natalie, what is your favorite word?
My favorite word, I think right now, would be spirited.
What is your least favorite word?
Problematic.
What turns you on?
Good food.
What turns you off?
Vulgarity.
What sound or noise do you love?
Nails on a chalkboard.
That's what you love?
The sound that I love?
Yeah.
The sound of my dog's paws.
Natalie, what is your favorite curse word?
My favorite curse word would be mother effer.
Oh, you can say it if you want. What profession other than yours would you like to attempt?
Dancer.
What profession would you absolutely not like to attempt?
Sanitation worker.
And finally, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say to you when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Well done.
Quickly, tell us what you have going on and where our listeners can find out more information about you and your projects.
Okay, we are producing a 6-part documentary series on African-American immigration, and you can learn more at my website, www.AfricanAmericanImmigrationDoc.com.
Natalie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sergio.
And that does it
thank
for
you.
Us. And that does it for us this week. Thank you all so much for joining us. Please tune in next week every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Radio Free Brooklyn. Today we're going to close out with a little, dare I say, forgive me if I mispronounce this, but Vusi Mahalasala is quite an artist, in my opinion. And you are, this has been Revolutionary Abolitionist Radio. Thank you again for joining us. You are listening to Radio Free Brooklyn.
His sad melodies coming out like a smoke from the woody fire. And he sang, my boo, Africa, sing now, Africa, sing loud, sing to the people. Let them give something to the world and not just take it from it. And will ring the bells when you come back? Will you beat the drums when you come back? Will you ring the bells when you come back? Will you beat the drums?